Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We're going to focus on the systemic roots of racism and policing, mass incarceration, resistance, and social transformation. The really important, remarkable speech that Christopher Hedges gave before what I think is one of the most important grassroots organization in the country, and that is the People's Organization for Progress.
Let me just take a second to concur
sure.
with you, because I think that that organization not only does a lot of things on a lot of different issues, but also is a model for what we should be doing in this area and around the country, because it really does hit on all of the major issues, from employment and unemployment to civil rights to civil liberties to war and peace. This is an organization that really has it all.
It melds race and class, and the particular presentation that Pop brought Christopher Hedges out for was based on racism and policing and mass incarceration and resistance and social transformation. It is one of the preeminent organizations for 25 years that has been addressing the issue of police abuse of power, of police murder. And indeed, as Kent said, is, I think, a model to be replicated and grown for all of us to become part of and incorporate the methodology and ideology back into our respective communities. Well, Chris Hedges, he was invited. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize winner. Oh, he's the author of some 12 books, working on another one. He is a recipient of the Amnesty International's Global Award of Human Rights Journalism. He's a truth dig columnist. He's an educator. He's got a prison ministry and is an educator behind the walls in the U.S. prison system. He's an Occupy activist. And Larry Hamm's going to open, the director of the People's Organization for Project. And we're going to begin in earnest to talk about and listen to the systemic roots of racism and policing, mass incarceration, resistance, and social transformation.
We have a special guest speaker, Chris Hedges. He is not just an award-winning author, he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Currently a columnist for Truth Dig, and most importantly, he is an activist for social change. Chris Hedges has written 12 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Some of his other books include Death of the Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, and the best-selling American Fascists, The Christian Right, and The War on America. His book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. In 2011, Nation Books published a collection of Hedges' Truth Dig columns called The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. And I might also add, and I know some of you will find this surprising, Chris Hedges was ordained as a minister on Sunday. He is the Reverend Hedges. He is going to address the topic, police brutality, mass incarceration, resistance, and social transformation. Let's give a warm POP welcome to Chris Hedges. And he is a member of the People's Organization for Progress.
A dues-paying member. I'm going to begin by talking about a little bit about the prison system itself. Well, there are certainly some people in the room who know a lot more about it than I do. But I've taught for many years in several prisons in Trenton. Were you in Trenton?
Yes.
Yeah, I taught all summer there. And Rahway, where I've taught for a while, a couple years, and Wagner. I was a seminary graduate, by the way, 31 years ago, and was 20 years overseas And when I came back to the United States, I'd spent 20 years in the developing countries in Latin America, in the Middle East, much of that time in places like Gaza, covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for 3 years, since Sarajevo during the war, Kosovo. And when I came back to the United States, just as I had been overseas in communities of severe oppression, and in many cases oppression directed by the United States, that was certainly true in places like Gaza or in Central America, I sought out marginal communities that were suffering from the effects of empire internally. And in my last book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which I wrote with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, we went to the poorest pockets of the United States, the sacrifice zone, places where whole communities have been rendered invisible to the wider society. Spent many weeks in Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, and we were there, per capita, the most dangerous. We were in the coal fields of southern West Virginia, in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, Lakota Sioux Indian Reservation, where the average life expectancy is 48. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. At any one time on Pine Ridge, 60% of the population have neither running water or electricity. That's America. And then the produce fields, and we went to Florida because the labor laws are the most draconian in the country as opposed to California. For example, in Florida, while collective bargaining is technically legal, a large agribusiness can fire their workers if they find that they are attempting to actually organize with no legal ramifications. Now, the reason we went to these sacrifice zones, as we call them, these places where people have been utterly disempowered, their environments have been poisoned and destroyed, they have virtually no protection under the law. Indeed, the law essentially works as an instrument of oppression, is because we wanted to give readers an idea of what unfettered, unregulated capitalism looks like, what it does when it has no control. And as Karl Marx understood, unfettered, unregulated capitalism is a revolutionary force. It has no internal limits. It will turn everything into commodities. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that it then exploits until exhaustion or collapse. The reason I did it with Sacco is because I know that we don't see these people. These people are never shown. The only time poor people are ever shown in the mass media is when we ridicule them on Jerry Springer. We make fun of them. That's the only time they ever appear on the mass media. All their dignity, their struggle, their oppression, none of that is ever captured by the commercial media. Poor people are just, they're the butt of jokes of the commercial media. Right. And so we wanted to draw it out so that people could visually see what the wider culture never shows them. That it wasn't just about reporting, it was about showing their faces, showing their landscapes. And one of the things you can do in comic panels that you can't do in photographs is you can recreate a history. For instance, we interviewed a 92-year-old coal miner who had begun, like many people, working in the mines right after his father was killed in a mine accident in the 30s. This was before unions, before the mines were mechanized, and trace his life. When we met him, he was dying of black lung. All miners who spend significant amounts of time in the mines get black lung. Very few live to 92. He'd been fighting black lung for 20 years. But it was a way to take panels and just show his life. We did that with a woman in Camden with her life as well. So you could not only tell the story, but you give people a visual image of that story. The reason we wanted to write about those sacrifice zones is because now the whole country has become a sacrifice zone. That what's happened in these places is now happening everywhere. Increasingly, it's turned from an assault against poor people within pockets to poor people across the country, working people across the country, and increasingly the white middle class, which is beginning for the first time to feel the kind of effects of repression that people who've lived in marginal communities, especially people of color, have felt for decades. And that was, of course, one of the impetus behind the Occupy movement. These, in essence, were the largely white sons and daughters of the middle class who suddenly confronted police brutality. It was a big surprise, of course, to them that there was police brutality. Suddenly confronted the fact that they couldn't get meaningful work. Suddenly confronted issues like foreclosures, bank repossessions. And this is something that I fault, especially the white liberal class, where the white liberal class, and this was essentially orchestrated by figures like Clinton out of the Democratic Party, what they did is essentially forgot the fundamental issue of justice. So while the poor and working men and women in this country were being essentially stripped of any power to defend themselves and any power to earn a living, that white liberal class was busying itself with other issues and turning their backs on them. And that, of course, was a fatal mistake, because once they finished with poor and the working class, they have turned on that segment of the white middle class as well. I don't have to tell anyone in pop this, but one of the main instruments of social control became, of course, mass incarceration and the use of the drug laws, the excuse of drug laws, by which especially poor men of color, whose bodies were worth nothing on the streets of Newark, behind bars, are suddenly worth $40,000 or $50,000 to phone companies. And I just tried to send money to a friend of mine through a commissary, and you know they passed it all now to this private company. If you send $20, they want $5.
Wow.
Every single way that they can gouge the poor, the prison in Rahway. If a relative of yours dies, you can go either have a deathbed visit or the wake for 15 minutes, but they charge you $800. Did you know that? $800. If you're earning $1 a day, think how long it takes to pay off $800. You pay that $800 for those two guards to go shackled for 15 minutes, you got to pay them $800. This is something that undocumented workers are experiencing. ICE just uses undocumented workers like an ATM machine because they have zero right. So they will pick them up for fines that if you are a citizen, you might not even have a fine, but they have a whole different fine system. And these are some of the poorest people in the country. $1,000 for driving without a license, whatever it is. And they're going to be deported, but they loot as much money as they can from them on the way out the door. What is it that we've created, essentially, through the power to create police forces in cities like Newark, Camden, wherever it is, that are omnipotent? By omnipotent, meaning they have essentially been given the legal right to serve as judge, jury, and executioner.
Mm.
There's a political philosopher I like very much named Hannah Arendt, who writes in her book, Origins of Totalitarianism, about precisely this issue. She had fled Nazi Germany as a Jew to France. Once she fled Nazi Germany, she was stripped of her German citizenship, so she became, on the eve of World War II, that large group of people who were defined as stateless, meaning they had no legal documents, in the same way that undocumented workers in this country are stateless, and therefore the systems of authority, and in particular the judicial systems and the systems of law enforcement, can do whatever they want with them. So she wrote about what happened when you create these omnipotent policing forces that are able to prey on groups of people who essentially have been stripped of their rights, either because they're poor and they live in communities like Newark, or because they're undocumented. And she said that what happens is that once you create the physical mechanism of omnipotent policing, the ability of the police, as you all know, to kick down your doors in the middle of the night, supposedly delivering a warrant for a nonviolent offense, that, when it's twinned with the corruption of the legal system, essentially becomes a recipe for totalitarianism. So what we've seen over the last few years is an evisceration of our most basic constitutional rights. Wholesale surveillance, everybody in this room, every form of electronic communication we have is captured, downloaded, and stored by the government. We are the most photographed, monitored, watched, eavesdropped population in human history.
Yes.
And I covered the East German state, the Stasi. I covered it as a reporter. I covered the collapse of East Germany and the kinds of things that the state is able to do to us now, the Stasi never even dreamt of.
Wow.
And all of this stuff is stored in perpetuity in government computers. Why? And again, we go back to a writer on totalitarianism like Arendt. She said that in totalitarian systems, the reason they take and capture all of your information and store it is not essentially because they are looking for a crime. It's because at the moment that they seek to criminalize an entire class of people, they have enough information on you that they can seize and pick whatever they want to use it to justify incarceration and detention. And so this system of mass surveillance, which looks benign relatively, in a period of relative stability, in a period of instability becomes a potent weapon in the hands of the state, by which you can essentially round up and crush any forms of legitimate dissent. And we've already seen that with the Occupy movement. Again, just as the drug laws essentially were used to create the physical presence of militarized, omnipotent policing, the laws ostensibly passed against Islamic terrorism gave the state the ability to create a legal structure by which a citizen can be instantly stripped of all of their rights. So one of the things that we've seen, and I was very involved in the Occupy movement, one of the things we've seen with Occupy activists is that because they communicated electronically, the state knows who they are. They know who's important and who isn't. And we have seen the state, since the closure of the Zuccotti Occupy encampment, go back, and because I was involved, I know that they've got the right people. They know exactly who to target. They know who are the engines behind movements like that, because they were communicating electronically. And so what they've done to essentially, and this gets right back to essentially what's happening in inner cities, is they've used felony convictions to essentially neutralize activists. And the way they do it, they charge you, in the same way they do in a community like Newark, they charge you with a bunch of crimes for which you can go to jail for a long period of time, very few, if any, that you actually committed, but that, of course, doesn't matter. The point is to force you to plea out. And I'll give you an example. One of the activists that I worked with, really interesting guy, by the way, he had gone to Columbia University on a football scholarship and had gotten quite injured in a game his freshman year, started tutoring up in Harlem, kind of awoke his consciousness. He ended up dropping out of Columbia, went back to California, became an activist, ended up finishing his degree at Berkeley. He was in the park. He was a very important figure, there from the first day, part of the Direct Action Committee. And what they did is the cops arrested him when he had a pair of scissors in his hand, and they charged him with assault with a deadly weapon against a New York City police officer, which was a mandatory sentence of 7 years. Now, what I love about this is they had a platform, if any of you were at Zuccotti, where they filmed 24 hours a day.
Right.
But, of course, they didn't happen to have film of this because it didn't happen. So they bring him up in the court. Initially, the defense attorney wants a plea agreement, and the prosecutor says, we're not going to offer a plea because he's on the homeland terrorism list.
Wow.
They eventually let him plea if he accepted a felony conviction with 5 years probation. That's exactly what they do. And that's what they do. You know, so many of my students in the prison system, you know, the prosecutor is kind of selling them on this deal, but they don't understand the consequences of having a felony conviction on their record, even if they'd never spent a day in jail or a day in prison. And that is the way that they have been steadily using this form of electronic surveillance to neutralize activists. So much of what's happening in inner city environments, such as Camden, such as Newark, and others, are now being replicated in the wider society. And it is through the use of the so-called war on drugs and the so-called war on terror, which give the state the kind of excuse to strip us of any kind of judicial or legal protection. And we've seen this in my own case, that I sued Barack Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act in the Southern District Court in New York. Section 1021 permits the U.S. military, this overturns over 150 years of domestic law, permits the U.S. military to seize American citizens who, in the language of this section, substantially support Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces. Now, substantially support is not a legal term. It's not material support. It's open to wide interpretation. And what are associated forces? To hold them in military facilities, strip them of due process, and keep them there indefinitely, in the language of that section, until the end of hostilities. All of this is important because you have an evisceration of the legal system, which the kind of bellwether, the canary in the coal mine, began with poor communities where people of color, and let's talk in terms of Marx, essentially superfluous labor. They moved manufacturing overseas so they could pay sweatshop workers in Bangladesh 22 cents an hour and exploit them in a form of neo-slavery, in essence, which is what capitalists do. And so all these people who had manufacturing jobs in places like Newark Trenton was a big, Camden used to be a huge manufacturing center. Campbell Soup, RCA, 36,000 people used to work in that port. They've suddenly got all this superfluous labor. The question is, how are they going to make money off of this labor? The way they make money off of this labor is the business of mass incarceration. That's it. It's a big business. That's all it is. I forget your name again. What's
I mean, Earl, I mean.
Earl, who should probably be up here talking, not me. But, I mean, Earl can tell you, the stories you hear inside those prisons would just rip your heart out. Story after story. Nobody gets a fair hearing. The system, as a matter of fact, the people who usually have the longest sentences are the ones who went to trial. Because they got to pressure you to plea out. If everybody goes to trial, the system's going to collapse. So if you go to trial, which often are the people who kind of, especially if they're young, they're kind of naive. Well, I didn't do it. I mean, I got a guy from Elizabeth. He was 5 years on the U.S. Army boxing team. Incredible guy. Comes back to Elizabeth, out of the Army, and he's training to go pro, to be a professional boxer. And he gets picked up. It's the typical thing where they stack him full of all sorts of charges for crimes he didn't commit. They offer him a 16-month plea. He said, okay, plea out. He goes, I didn't do it. And I'm not going to plea out because if I spend 60 months sitting in a jail cell, I'm finished. It'll take me 2 years to get back to this level and, you know, become a boxer. Plus, he's going to be 2 years older. So he goes to court, and they give him a 30-year sentence. He's sitting in Rahway. I got a guy in Rahway. He's 39 now. He was arrested in Camden when he was 14 years old. There was a knifing. It was part of a gang. He goes, I was 90 pounds. He may have been there. I'm pretty certain he didn't do it. So they take a 14-year-old boy, they haul him into the police station in Camden, and they won't let his mother come in until 2 in the morning. The kid's crying. He just wants to go home. He's 14 years old. He signs a confession. That's how it works. Sign it, you go home. He's 14. No lawyer, no mother, no guardian, no nothing. He's put in with the adult population at 14. He is not eligible to go before a parole board till he's 70. There's story after story like that. And of course, you're marked once you get out. No food stamps, no public housing. I'm not telling anyone in the room that. So that the system essentially perpetuates itself. And one of the things that's interesting as we see the breakdown of the wider society is that white people, beginning with white poor people who had ignored this as an issue, are now getting picked up in rural communities largely on meth and being treated the way people of color have been treated for several decades. And that goes right back to Hannah Arendt. Once you create these systems, they become insidious. As the wider society devolves, the legal structure is eviscerated. You always look for the excuse. You know, Muslim terrorists become the excuse by which we're all supposed to give up all of our civil liberties. Drug dealers, drug people, they've always got an excuse. But once you normalize that kind of activity, coupled with the economic evisceration that has happened, where you have created essentially an oligarchic system, a global oligarchic elite, where none of these guys pay taxes. They have committed massive amounts of fraud and criminal activity. That's not an accusation. That's a documented fact. And yet they never go to jail, ever. Now, the danger of this is that, and we'll go back to Marx, because there are no internal limits in terms of unregulated capitalism, because it will continue to exploit and exploit and exploit. The only thing unfettered capitalists understand is more. Because they have no internal limits, then eventually there's going to be some kind of blowback, both in terms of the effects of climate change. I mean, the fossil fuel industry determine our relationship to the ecosystem, and anybody who reads climate change reports is probably as terrified as I am, one of the last ones being that the biosphere is no longer capable of absorbing the CO2 emissions and everything else, coupled with this recreation of the neo-feudal economy, a world where you have an oligarchic elite and two-thirds of the country hanging on by their fingertips, crippled by debt peonage. Debt peonage, of course, has always been an effective form of social control. It's the way after emancipation, black people were kept in slavery by another name. Debt peonage, we have loaded that up on our young. The largest personal debt in the country, $1 trillion, are these kids who graduated from college. And look what our government has done. If you declare bankruptcy, it doesn't affect your student loans. How thoughtful of the Congress to pass this law. Not only that, but you pay an interest rate that is actually higher than the bank interest rate.
Wow.
So these kids get out of college, they're hit with $600, $700, $800 a month often, and they, of course, can't find a job. That is what, of course, triggered the Occupy movement. And I think one of the things that is so painful is teaching in a place like Rahway or Trenton this summer and running into these individuals who are so brilliant, have so much integrity, have so much to offer to the wider society, and are just sitting behind bars for decades, unheralded, unappreciated, and even reviled by the wider community. Last fall, taught a course on drama. So we read James Baldwin, August Wilson's Fences. But what was interesting is I, as an experiment, the first week, I said, okay, I want you to sit and read these plays, and we'll discuss them, but I want you to write dramatic scenes from your own life, not necessarily off of the street, even just between you and your mother, what you remember, you and your brother. And so I had 28 students, and that first week, I got all those 28 scenes. There's a kind of smell of prison. The cat is in the paper, you know, when I would bring it home. And I would smell the, you know, that kind of musty smell. And I'd smell it. It was kind of quite powerful. I'd bring in those papers, and I started going through them. I get, you know, 3-4 scenes in, and I suddenly hit this thing of gold. I'm a writer. And then a couple more, I hit this thing of gold. I had like 5 or 6 guys in there who could really write. Mm. I was taking all of these scenes and trying to hammer them into a play. Right. Name of the play, by the way, is Caged. So I thought, what am I going to do? I mean, they put all this work into it, and I told them I would take it to every theater director I knew in New York. Mm. But that getting a play produced in New York was like winning the lottery. And I did take it to every theater director in New York. And it will be produced in a New York theater in the fall of 2010. Yeah.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. Thank you.